Welcome to the 2:30 docket of Division 6 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. Council, have you both had the opportunity to review the policies and procedures handout for oral arguments on council's table?
Yes, Your Honor.
And do you have any questions about any of those matters?
No, Your Honor.
I would also, yes. We were planning on having 15 minutes for each case, the 15 minutes for the merits and 15 minutes for the attorney's fees
per side.
Matter per side.
My understanding from the order of is the court because there's more issues on the main appeal that we combine the two amounts.
I wasn't.
Do you have the order?
Yeah, do you have a copy of that? I was not aware that there had been an order combining or granting 30 minutes for argument. Yes, please. Thank you, counsel. We were not aware of that order, so we will obviously follow it, and there will be 30 minutes per side, which will constitute the total argument for both cases, for the merits case and the attorney's fees case. As appellant counsel, you can reserve the amount of time you might want to reserve for a rebuttal. Under our present timing system, that's up to you to keep track of that. Since we have 30 minutes per side, I would, can you set the Amber to go off at 10 minutes remaining?
Okay. Thanks, that's what I was just gonna ask. Yeah.
And if you want me to try to help you remember what time you want to reserve, let me know. Otherwise, you just monitor yourself for the number for the time you want to reserve. I'll remind everyone, please, to turn off any cell phones or pagers or any other devices you might have that might go off during argument. We have another matter before the court before we begin. And that is with regard to, I believe it was Mr. Hess's motion to supplement the record on appeal. This is Appellee Cross Appellant David Hess's motion to supplement the record on appeal. Division has considered that motion, and the motion is denied. Is there anything else that we need to cover before argument proceeds? Okay, we're ready when you are, sir.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm David Kirch, and I represent Eve Sposato, the appellant and cross-appellee in this case. I'm going to use up the first 15 minutes of my time addressing just the issues on appeal and then reserve the balance of my time to address the issues on the cross-appeal and the attorney's fees. I think that will be less confusing because there's so many issues involved. The first issue I'd like to address with respect to the appeal relates to the first of the two grounds that the trial court entered judgment against my client on that grounds is based on the Hine case. As Jim Wade recognizes in his treatise on estate administration, Hine was a case involving self-dealing. In Hine, a trustee had made personal use of a condominium trust property. In the present case, the transfer involved was a 1998 transfer, consolidation of a Morgan Stanley individual account into a Morgan Stanley joint tenancy account. Mr. Hess acknowledges that there is no evidence in the record that Eve Spisato was involved in the making of that transfer. The only paperwork signed by anyone in connection with the transfer was a tax form, and that was signed by Bonnie Ritchie herself. Mr. Hess is proposing that this court adopt a broader rule of self-dealing, in effect saying that any time somebody receives the benefit of a transfer who may be deemed to be a fiduciary of the person making the transfer, whether or not that person making the transfer has capacity and whether or not that person making the transfer is doing so without undue influence, that this court should deem that transfer self-dealing. Such an extension of Hine would bring within the scope of Hine all those cases where an individual may be acting as under power of attorney, a durable power of attorney, when the person is incapacitated. That's necessary for there to be a fiduciary duty. In this case, it was a non-durable power of attorney.
Is that really what appellees are arguing with regard to Hine? It seems to me that the appellees were arguing that if you have those circumstances you just mentioned, that it raises a presumption, a rebuttable presumption under Hine, that there was undue influence.
That's what they would explain.
Am I misunderstanding appellees' arguments or the way you're characterizing them?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. So if a person is serving, for example, as trustee of a revocable trust, and they were a remainderman, there would be self-dealing in them receiving benefits under that trust at the death of the settlor, because they were a fiduciary, they were a trustee. If a person were serving under a durable power of attorney, which we don't have here, and the principal decided to name that agent, who is often a family member or a close friend, as a beneficiary in a life insurance policy or under a POD arrangement in a bank account or as a joint tenant as here, under the scope of Hine, which the trial court apparently adopted based on Mr. Hess's raising that, that would then be an act of self-dealing. That would create a presumption of undue influence.
Now, this court, you say that would be an act of self-dealing, and then you say it would create a presumption, those are two different things. I don't believe Hine says that it would be an act of self-dealing. It says it would raise a rebuttable presumption.
But the Hine case involves self-dealing, and if you look at Hine and you compare that with the Equitex case, that's a good example of a situation where people did have what could be noted as a fiduciary relationship, and the court in that case said there has to be a connection between that fiduciary relationship and the transfer in order for there to be a breach of fiduciary duty, in order for the presumption to arise. If you don't have that connection, then every person who's been named as a beneficiary under life insurance, joint tenancy, POD, is going to have to be called into court and face this expansive presumption of undue influence.
Wasn't there a connection in this instance between Ms. Posado's assistance of Ms. Ritchie with her financial affairs, including the Morgan Stanley Dean Witter account? Wasn't there a nexus there between her conduct and the transfer into this joint account?
No, Your Honor. In this case, The evidence at trial showed that Bonnie Ritchie continued to have full capacity. She continued to be strong-willed and in control of her finances. In this case, there was no evidence of any involvement by Eves Passato in that account transfer.
So do I understand correctly, Mr. Kirch, that your argument is that in order for there to be a presumption of self-dealing, that you would require that not only the person be a fiduciary and not only that there be a transfer, but that it must be shown that the fiduciary participated in the transfer?
Exactly. That's the Equitex case, basically, saying there must be that connection. Otherwise, you're pulling in all these transfers being subject to question where there's no evidence that the fiduciary was involved in the transfer.
As opposed to the situation, as I understand it, that Mr. Hess is arguing that the presumption could arise simply because the fiduciary will benefit from that, but then the fiduciary could show that he or she had not engaged in the self-dealing. They could come forward with evidence that says, I did not participate.
That would mean that every individual who's a beneficiary of a non-probate transfer then could be called into court under that presumption. It would seem to me that unless it's shown that that individual had been involved in the making of that transfer, that just simply because they benefit shouldn't be deemed self-dealing. Hine was a self-dealing case. That it's not self-dealing if the transfer is made by a competent individual who intended to make the transfer. And there's two exhibits in the record, 1997 and 1998 documents signed by Bonnie Ritchie, where she made it clear that she wanted Eves Passato to have these assets. This transfer was consistent with her intentions when she had capacity. To extend the presumption to every situation where somebody in one role may be a fiduciary and may, on the other hand, at some point in time, benefit at death because of transfer at death is not an appropriate use of the presumption.
And are you saying that Mr. Hess is trying to expand the presumption?
Exactly, because here there was no evidence of self-dealing.
Thank you.
I would point out that the trial court on summary judgment had ruled that the presumption of undue influence had been rebutted by Eves Passato, that because Mr. Hess had failed to present any evidence in response to the summary judgment motion of actual undue influence, the court entered summary judgment on the undue influence claim. What happened is for the first time in closing argument, the Hine case was mentioned. Never being argued before, damages by virtue of this transfer were not included in the damages that Mr. Hess had listed in his proposed pretrial of trial management order. For the first time at closing arguments, Hine was raised, and the court, in order to apply Hine, having already ruled that the presumption of undue influence had been rebutted, in effect created under Hine a second presumption.
Where did the trial court rule that the presumption of undue influence had been rebutted?
On summary judgment, Your Honor.
Okay.
It
dismissed the undue influence claim.
That's correct.
But it never ruled about the presumption of undue influence that arises because of Hine being rebutted.
Hine is the same presumption, Your Honor. That's the fallacy in applying Hine in this case. If you read the Kruger case decided by this court, it recognizes that the presumption of undue influence and the presumption of unfairness are in effect the same presumption. It's a single presumption, not two presumptions. Sometimes undue influence is the appropriate approach, sometimes the appropriate approach is fairness. But it's not two separate presumptions, two separate hurdles that parties have to overcome. Kruger recognized that. Also, I would point out, Your Honor, that if you look at the order of the court ruled that Mrs. Passato failed to show that the transfers were fair. The court did not treat this as a shifting burden of going forward with the evidence. The court treated this as the burden of presumption, expecting Mrs. Passato to show Never having been confronted with this Heim case during the, before the trial and during the trial, she was required to then show that the transfers were fair. Well, it would seem to me if transfers are made by a competent individual who has full capacity, that should be presumed to be fair. Doesn't that show that the transfer is fair? Is this court going to get in the business of looking at whether or not transfers made by competent individuals where there's no undue influence are fair or not? That's what Mr. Hess's position would require the courts to do. I'll move next to issue.
I have a question about that. You seem to be discussing the motion for summary judgment in tandem with the issues about this transfer. But let's talk about the motion for summary judgment for a moment. Assuming that the affidavits that were attached to the motion that was filed by your client indicated or got rid of the presumption, the rebuttable presumption, what Kruger and the other cases say is the case then goes to the fact finder with or without the presumption for the fact finder to determine if they were in fact fair transfers. So why is it that you're assuming that you just win summary judgment instead of having a trial by a fact finder?
Because the court dismissed the claim for undue influence.
I understand that. But was it correct in doing so, given that Kruger and the other cases indicate that you're supposed to have a trial to a fact finder?
If that were the correct reasoning, that would mean that if there's any sort of evidentiary presumption, that a party never would be entitled to summary judgment. That would mean that you would have to go to trial every time there's an evidentiary presumption. That's not the purpose of the evidentiary presumptions. It's to try to create an equal playing field. To rule in that fashion would so dramatically tip the scales against the parties against whom the presumption arises. And remember, the presumption arises because of a confidential relationship. What you're dealing with here.
Talk about Kruger. Kruger indicates that the presumption may or may not go away, but the issue of fact doesn't go away. The issue goes to the finder of fact in a trial.
But there was no remaining cause of action for undue influence. The court had dismissed that. The only remaining cause of action.
I understand the court dismissed it. What I'm trying to determine is why that's defensible, that it dismissed the claim instead of having a trial on it.
Because once the
presumption goes away.
Once the presumption is rebutted.
That doesn't mean you
then
win.
Then the other party. Excuse me, Your Honor. Go ahead.
That doesn't mean that you win. It just means the presumption goes away.
Then the burden shifts to the other party.
Right.
To present evidence of undue influence.
Did they
that
do
has,
so? In
there
this
was
instance?
Absolutely no evidence of undue influence provided to the court in connection with summary judgment. The affidavits provided gave no suggestion of undue influence. The presumption was gone. Mr. Hess was not able to come forward with any evidence of undue influence. The court properly granted summary judgment. Why should my client have to go to trial on that issue when Mr. Hess has demonstrated by his failure to produce affidavits that they have no actual evidence of undue influence? They were relying entirely on the presumption.
Well, that's in the event you or the court buys your argument about the meaning of Kruger. In order for your argument now to be persuasive, we would have to find that Hain gives rise to only one presumption, the presumption of undue influence, and that Kruger does not change that by adding another presumption of unfairness and unreasonableness.
Right. That's correct.
That
this
correct?
Court would have to, and if you read Kruger, I think it makes it clear that it's an interchangeable presumption. It's not two presumptions, it's a single presumption. I'd like to move on now to the second grounds, which was the Safeway account transfers, the $30,000 in transfers. That was based on the trial court's independent conclusion in looking at two documents signed by Bonnie Ritchie in 1997 and 1998. Its interpretation of a document, its strained interpretation of a document, and I assume the court is familiar with that document, that Bonnie Ritchie intended for assets other than the Safeway account to be used to pay her nursing home expenses. There's nothing in that document that says that. What the document says that if I have to use I give the Safeway account if I don't have to use it to pay my nursing home expenses. That would imply to me that what she was trying to do in this 98 document was, in addition to a 97 document, she added that in the 98 document. The logical reading of that is that she was trying to make it clear which expenses would be paid from which assets. She'd indicated that her debts and expenses of remodeling a residence were paid from the other assets, not the Safeway account. She was saying here that the Safeway account should be used to pay those expenses. That's the natural reading of that document. Logically, that her cash assets should be used.
Could it not be interpreted also to mean that the Safeway account funds would be used to pay the nursing home expenses once the rest of the accounts were depleted?
That doesn't appear in the document. That's not a natural reading of the document, and that's contrary to the extrinsic evidence, Your Honor, at trial, which showed that Ritchie.
Trial court found that that was the clear meaning of these documents, did it not?
It didn't acknowledge that there was an ambiguity. I don't think there is an ambiguity. It seems to me it was clear she wanted the Safeway account to pay those expenses. But if you do say there was an ambiguity, then under Palazzi, you would look at the extrinsic evidence. And the extrinsic evidence here was, first of all, that this was Mr. Hess's testimony, that Bonnie Ritchie had a lot of pride in her investments. And that makes sense, that she would not have wanted her investments to be used during her lifetime to pay care expenses. Also, Bob Spisato testified. Yes, Your Honor.
I was just going to ask, what is the standard of review by which we review these two documents?
It's de novo, Your Honor. The interpretation of a document is a de novo review by the court.
And if we review these documents and find them to be ambiguous, what would our recourse be?
Well, I think the court would then look at extrinsic evidence, Bonnie Ritchie's pride in her investment account, Bob Spisato's testimony that in the nursing home, Bonnie Ritchie told Eve Spisato.
Are you saying that we could look at the extrinsic evidence?
I think so, in a de novo review. In interpreting the document, this court can look at extrinsic evidence. I believe that's what happened in Palazzi also. That would be part of the de novo review.
Well, the trial court is supposed to do that, is supposed to look at extrinsic evidence, and your brief indicates that it did not. However, such evidence was admitted at trial, was it not?
It was.
And the trial court found that it was not persuasive, right?
It didn't. That's not in the trial court's ruling. The trial court did not consider, based on its order, there is no indication it considered that extrinsic evidence.
Okay. If the court considered it and determined that it was not persuasive, wouldn't it have done exactly what it did do, which is rule against your client on that issue?
There was no evidence to the contrary, Your Honor. There was no evidence to support the trial court's interpretation of that document.
So you're asking us to review the trial court's factual finding, which it comes under a clearly erroneous standard, correct?
No, again, interpret the document in light of the evidence. A de novo review of the document.
We don't do de novo review of evidence. We'll do de novo review of a document, but not of evidence.
Right, but the extrinsic evidence would certainly be something that could be taken into account in interpreting the document.
We don't do that here, sir.
There, and there's no indication in the record that the trial court did that. Moving on to the other issues.
You have about 10 and a half minutes.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll just state that, again, that the issues, these issues were not raised until trial or closing arguments. Mr. Hess himself never argued for the interpretation of the Safeway, the document relating to the Safeway account. This was something that was brought up at trial. There was not fair notice to my client on that. I'll reserve the rest of my time, Your Honor.
Counsel, you may proceed.
Counsel, Ms. Spisato, Your Honors, good afternoon. It's good to be with you on this beautiful Colorado afternoon. With me is Russ Jones. He wrote our briefs. And we agree that Eve Spasato was a good friend to Bonnie Ritchie, but it's also clear from the evidence that Ms. Spasato felt entitled to Bonnie Ritchie's money. And as we proved at trial, Ms. Spasato was willing to breach her fiduciary duty to get that money. The trial court found two examples of breach of fiduciary duty for which it awarded damages to the estate. And those were the Safeway account, where a copy of the power of attorney was delivered to Safeway and was found in the Safeway savings account records, listing Mrs. Spasato as Bonnie Ritchie's agent, although the account was set up as a joint tenancy account and not as an agency account. Safeway was in possession of the power of attorney. And under the Nichols case, they are on notice of that agency relationship as a result of the delivery of the power of attorney. In the Morgan Stanley account, the agency account there, the account was set up as an agency account. I don't understand how Mr. Kirch can argue that it wasn't a formal fiduciary relationship. By statute, the agent has no interest in the account.
How was it set up? What kind of evidence do we have that it was set up as an agency account?
We have the account form that says it's an agency account.
And who put that on there? Who wrote that on that account form? Do you know?
Somebody at Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter, I assume. That's the way they set it up.
Was there a copy of the power of attorney and the files regarding the Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter account?
No. This is very curious. Siegel, the stockbroker, said he was never told that there was a fiduciary relationship. But he set the agency account up as an agency account. And that was simply unexplained. So by statute, if it's an agency account, the principal owns the money and the agency manages the account. That's the only way the account can operate. And that means Ms. Spasato had to participate in moving that money over to the joint account. That's the only way it could have happened. Couldn't be done without her signature, because she's the agent. She's the one who controls the account.
That's premised on your argument that this word agent on there makes it an agency account.
Correct.
Is that necessary to a finding of, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, sir.
I'm sorry, I'm John Case.
John Case. Mr. Case, is that necessary to a finding of fiduciary relationship in this case?
No. No, we why not? Because there's a confidential relationship where Ms. Spasato herself acknowledges that Bonnie Ritchie asked her to manage her money, and that they had, so there's the fiduciary relationship. It's formalized in a power of attorney that was used. It was given to Safeway, and it was given to the nursing home when Bonnie Ritchie was admitted. So the power of attorney, which is her power to manage affairs, was used, and it was given by Bonnie Ritchie so she could have a fiduciary agent. And then Ms. Spasato admitted that there was a confidential and trusting relationship between her and Bonnie Ritchie. She admitted it in her deposition and again at trial. In the deposition, it was at page 177. The question was,
Your Honor, I don't know how this deposition is confidential.
Well, it's part of the record.
If it's part of the record, then we have it before us.
And she gave essentially the same testimony at trial. Question, would you say that's a confidential relationship on which she placed special trust in you? Answer, confidential relationship? Question, yes. As opposed, I don't understand. Here's the question. Did she place special trust in you as a friend? Answer, yes, she did. Question, did she depend on you to handle her financial affairs? Answer, yes, she did. Now that's a confidential relationship.
Is it correct that that deposition is not a part of the trial?
I'm not sure if it was admitted as an exhibit. I know it was included in the documents that were sent up here as part of the record.
Okay.
And the testimony at the trial was same effect. In fact, Mr. Kirch called a well-known trust officer in Denver as an expert, and the guy was sitting in the courtroom when Judge Munsinger announced, the way I see it, counsel, there was a fiduciary relationship here because Mrs. Fasato was managing the affairs of Mrs. Ritchie. And I find that she had fiduciary responsibilities because of that relationship. And as Judge Munsinger commented on the record, Mr. Kirch's expert was nodding while the judge said that, so he was never called as a witness. I mean, the idea that there's no fiduciary relationship, which Mr. Kirch has threaded throughout his briefs on both cases, that's preposterous. This began as a fiduciary relationship because Mrs. Ritchie had no family here to take care of her business affairs. And it started with putting her name on one account, the First Bank checking account. Then her name was added as a joint tenant on the Safeway account with a copy of the power of attorney. Then she was given a joint tenancy deed to the house. Then in 1995, she was deeded the entire house, but with instructions to use Bonnie Ritchie's money to fix up the house. And Bonnie Ritchie, after deeding the house to her, continued to live in the house. Then $176,000 came out of Bonnie Ritchie's investments, all of her money. And where did it go? In 1994, Mrs. Fasato suggests to Bonnie Ritchie, why don't you use my broker? He's doing pretty good for me. So $176,000 of Mrs. Ritchie's money goes into that joint account, and the broker is never told that there's a power of attorney in effect and that Mrs. Sposato was acting as a fiduciary.
Well, Mr. Case, assuming that for purposes of this argument that a fiduciary relationship has been established, has there been a finding by the trial court as to whether the transfer was fair or not? As I understand it, there was some indication that there were assets that were transferred to Mrs. Sposato. The burden then potentially at least shifted to show that the transfer was fair. Was there a finding by the trial court that it was not a fair transfer?
Well, I think on the Safeway account, clearly there was. Judge Munsinger said that money was intended for the family. And what happened is Ms. Fasato didn't want to draw down the joint tenancy account that she was going to get on Bonnie Ritchie's death. So she drew down the family account, take their money, use it for Bonnie's care, but the money that she was going to get, won't use that. And Judge Munsinger found, and I think his interpretation's correct, that the two notes from Bonnie Ritchie said that it was the Safeway account would be used only as a last resort because that money was to go to her family.
Well, let me ask the question a different way. Do you agree that Plummer and Krueger result in this case in a presumption arising that there was an unfair transfer or the conduct that occurred was unreasonable and unfair on the part of Mrs. Fasato?
I do.
And I think what Judge Terry was asking you is then, did Judge Munsinger consider whether or not Mrs. Fasato had come forward with some evidence that the transaction was fair and reasonable? Or did Judge Munsinger shift the burden of proof then to Ms. Sposato to prove that the transfer was fair and reasonable?
Okay, I see two questions there. One, was there an express finding that that there was no proof that it was fair and reasonable? And number two, did he shift the burden of persuasion?
Correct.
Okay. Well, as we argued in our brief, he didn't shift the burden of persuasion. He shifted the burden to go forward. And they're only, as to the Safeway account, their only evidence was, well, Your Honor, that was the money that was to be used first. The judge said, well, no, that's not the way I read the note. The note says it's to be used last. It's for her family. So she didn't produce any evidence that it was fair and reasonable. She just argued that the note meant something different than what Judge Munsinger found. Now, on the agency account, Ms. Fasato presented no evidence about why that money was transferred other than to argue that it was always intended to be part of the joint account, and nobody knows why they designated it as an agency account. So she didn't meet her burden there, clearly, because she didn't prove it was fair and reasonable. She just proved that there was a transfer. Did I answer your question, Your Honor?
Yes, thank you.
How much time do I have left?
19 and a half minutes.
Okay, let's see, am I going to get a rebuttal to, on the attorney's fees and cross-appeal issues, or?
Yes, you will. Stop the clock a minute, please. Thank you. We had not discussed that, and there is a cross-appeal. So since there is a cross-appeal, set the clock for 10 minutes for the yellow on this one also. And, okay. And you can reserve as much time as you want to respond or for rebuttal on the attorney's fee case or any rebuttal on the arguments about your cross appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay,
so let's fast forward here. I'm sorry, Judge Terry.
Let me go back, because we were talking about whether there was a determination by the trial court of fairness with regard to the transfer, and you said you talked about the Safeway transfer, but was there any finding by the trial court about the transfer with regard to Morgan Stanley Dean Litter investment account?
You mean the agency account, the $14,000 account?
I don't know how much money was in it, sir, but the...
Okay. Well, there was one Morgan Stanley Dean Witter account set up with $176,000 in it. Then that was in 1994. In 1998, there was another account, a separate account with a separate number. That's called the agency account, and Ms. Posada was listed as the agent. And all we know is that that money was transferred, and it had to be by Ms. Posada because she was the agent.
Right. And the court said it could not determine the specific manner in which the Morgan Stanley Dean Witter investment account, the individual account, was transferred into the joint account.
True.
All right. So where is there a finding that this was not a proper transfer by the trial court?
Well, I'm inferring it from the fact that he included it in the judgment. It was a transfer to the fiduciary.
How can we review the finding if it's just inferred?
Well, we know there was a transfer. And what Judge Munsinger is saying is, I don't know exactly how it took place, because no one could remember. But it was a transfer to the fiduciary, the agent, and the agent clearly had to initiate it or sign off on it because she had control of the account. It was an agency account. It couldn't be done any other way. Mrs. Ritchie would not have the power to sign that money over to the joint account because she didn't control the account. The agent did.
Did the power of attorney that you're referring to exclude Mrs. Ritchie from signing her own documents, even though she had designated Ms. Posada as an attorney in fact for her?
No. No, I'm just saying that with respect to the one account, the agency account, by statute, the agent has control of the money and signing the account documents, but the principal owns the money. That's what an agency account is. That's in the 1515-201 section of the code.
Okay.
I'm not trying to avoid your question.
Go ahead.
Okay. So can I fast forward now to April 10 of 2003? On that date, Mrs. Ritchie is in the nursing home, and she's been talking about being the Antichrist and getting remarried and having a baby. The nursing notes show the following. Her diagnosis is dementia, short-term memory loss, long-term memory loss, severely impaired decision-making. She requires total assistance to dress, total assistance to bathe, total assistance to go to the bathroom. She can't attend to her personal hygiene. She's unable to walk. And the nurse wrote, resident cognition has declined at this time. She is unable to make her needs known. That's April 3rd, 2003. 1 week later, Mrs. Posada goes to the nursing home with the Wells Fargo joint account contract. puts it in front of Mrs. Ritchie and says, sign here, and she does. If you look at the contract, she's barely able to write her own name. Now, what happened after that? A joint account is opened at Wells Fargo. Morgan Stanley closes the former account, which had $96,000 in it on the day that it was closed. And because of the new joint account contract at Wells Fargo, the money is wired from Morgan Stanley to Wells Fargo.
But so, wasn't the prior account also a joint account?
Yes, it was.
So why does it make a difference? Why do we have to look at whether that was a fair transfer or not?
Because there was a new contract signed by an incompetent person.
What difference does it make if it was a joint account previously and it's a joint account after the transfer? What difference does it make?
Well, because Mrs. Ritchie was not free to sign contracts because she was incompetent. And we don't know what she intended to do. She couldn't say what she wanted to do with that money.
Well, is there any indication she was incompetent before she created the initial joint account?
No, but as we pointed out, I see what your point, and that is, well, she set up a joint account in 1994, so why wouldn't she want the next account to be a joint account?
No, that's not quite it, counsel. If she set up a joint account and both people had control and the right to that account, then why would it matter as to, Ms. Posado could then take, as one of the joint owners of the account, transfer it over to another joint account?
Not during Bonnie Ritchie's lifetime, because she's a fiduciary. She can't transfer property to herself.
So your premise again is that in 1994, she was a fiduciary and not a joint holder of the account.
Yes, she had a power of attorney dated 1991, and she was managing the money in that account. She was the manager of the Morgan Stanley account. She made the investment decisions. She testified at the trial. There's this $25,000 check in February of 1999, which is shortly after Bonnie's last will. Eve Sposato gets a $25,000 check. It was actually made jointly to her and Bonnie Ritchie, and we asked her in her deposition, what's this $25,000 check for? I don't know, I can't remember. So Mr. Siegel says the same thing. I don't know, I can't remember. So we ask Eve Sposato at trial, well, what's this $25,000 for? Oh, I remember now. That was for me because I had done such a good job with the investment account. What did you use the money for? Well, I bought a new Chevy Tahoe that I titled in my name. And what was that for? Well, of course, that was for Bonnie Ritchie's benefit. So Ms. Sposato was managing that account for the benefit of Bonnie Ritchie. That, according to her, is why she got the gift of the $25,000.
Counsel, I would find it helpful if you directed us now to what holding of the trial court all of this pertains to, because what I'm hearing is a lot of factual discussion, which, as you know, we don't find fact. And so which of the trial court's decisions are you asking us to attend to?
For the $101,000, that's
all these facts that you're putting out there.
This is the first item in our cross appeal. And if there was ever a case of undue influence, this is it. The fiduciary shows up at the nursing home, puts a new contract in front of the incompetent person, has her sign it, and then transfers the amount out of Morgan Stanley and puts it into Wells Fargo under this new contract. To do that transaction, a conservator should have been appointed. You can't have an incompetent person signing contracts and just presume that they wanted what they decided to do in 1994.
And the court erred in what regard?
The judge did not give us relief on that claim. First, Judge Munsinger dismissed the undue influence claim on summary judgment without a single comment. So we don't know why it was dismissed.
Well, what are the damages, assuming that you do have a claim?
It's $101,000. Ms. Posado took that money shortly after Bonnie Ritchie died. She still has it.
But if she was entitled to it before the transfer also, why is it just the fact that it moved to a different bank? Why does that make a difference? You lost me.
Because joint accounts are contracts, and the normal rules of contract formation apply.
Well, if she hadn't moved the money, she could have still taken it out, right? Let's assume she hadn't moved the money to the other bank.
Sure.
What would have happened then?
Well, assuming that Bonnie Ritchie had not done anything else or requested anything else be done with the money, if the Morgan Stanley account had survived to date of death, the money would have gone to Eve Sposato.
So why is it different just because it changed banks? Why is there a different result?
Because it's a new contract. And you cannot have a joint account under Colorado law unless you have a valid contract. It is a matter of contract. So you have one contract at Morgan Stanley. That contract's dead. It's done. That account is closed. And you have a new contract at Wells Fargo that's brand new with an incompetent person signing the contract with her fiduciary at the request of the fiduciary.
So the harm occurs,
the harm occurs because a fiduciary goes in and puts a contract in front of an incompetent person and says, here, sign here.
So the contract basically is void, is what you're saying?
Yes.
And if the contract is void, then are you saying that rather than that money going back to from whence it came, rather that money goes into the estate?
Yes, because under Colorado law, the money in a joint account belongs to the person whose money who contributed the money to the account. So it was all Mrs. Ritchie's money. Ms. Posada admits she didn't put a penny in the account. I think I'll save the rest for a rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have almost 10 minutes, nine minutes and 56 seconds left.
First, Your Honor, as far as the issue of those transcripts from the prior proceeding being admitted into evidence, the record, volume 6, page 157, lines 17 through 19, the trial court specifically ruled that they would not be admitted into evidence. I would ask the court to look at the transfer form involved in the Morgan Stanley transfer. It isn't titled an agency account. There's a reference in there, which was put in there by somebody in the back office of Morgan Stanley, that Eve Sposato was Bonnie Ritchie's agent.
Well, sir, was Mrs. Sposato paying bills on behalf of and for the benefit of the decedent?
Some bills she paid. Some bills the decedent paid herself.
That's
she,
fine.
She
That's
billed,
all I needed to know.
She paid the bills at the direction. But, Your Honor, Mrs. Ritchie did not lose the capacity, lack the capacity, to manage her own affairs. She, in fact, hired Gene Sloan as her caregiver in 1997. Gene Sloan was her caregiver for 3 years.
I saw that in the briefs, yes, sir.
Moving on to the issue of management, the management was still in Bonnie Ritchie. Bonnie Ritchie was calling the shots. There's numerous written directions in the record showing that Bonnie Ritchie was calling the shots as far as the management of her own assets. The nieces, the closest family members of Bonnie Ritchie, testified that Bonnie Ritchie still continued to be controlling her finances.
And what does this testimony relate to as far as principle of law that we are considering today?
The question of whether or not Bonnie Ritchie was in fact dependent on Eve Sposato, which is the basis for the presumption of undue influence, the presumption of unfairness, assuming it's the same presumption in this case.
Are you saying that this testimony that you're now reciting to us is the some evidence brought forward by Eve Sposato to rebut the presumption that may have been raised under Hine and Kruger?
No, Your Honor. There were several affidavits in our appeal, the statement of the facts. There's a paragraph with dozens of references to the record establishing the fact that Bonnie Ritchie continued to be competent, a strong-willed individual in control of her own finances. Eve Spisato was basically a gopher, doing whatever Bonnie Ritchie asked her to do because Bonnie Ritchie was her best friend. That's the record in this case.
So she was acting as the agent for Ms. Ritchie, but she was not exercising undue influence.
That's correct. There was no evidence of undue influence. She was acting, a competent principal can have an agent take actions for them. That doesn't create a fiduciary duty. If you look at the statute, you'll see under powers of attorney, the provisions 15, I believe it's 14606, it's cited. The statute specifically provides that a person has to be acting under a power of attorney for an incompetent individual for there to be a fiduciary capacity. This was not a durable power of attorney. Eve Spisato could not have used it if Bonnie Ritchie had lost capacity. I would point out with respect to the argument that the Morgan, the Wells Fargo account should be ignored and the money's put back in the estate, that if in fact Bonnie Ritchie's signature was not valid on that, then the transfer was valid. Mr. Hess does not argue that the transfer was not valid. That would mean that it would be an individual account in Eve Spisato's name. That would be the logical conclusion of the argument, although I think Beasley makes it clear that the courts have looked at the intents of the party and the intent. Bonnie Ritchie's continuing intent was that those assets be held in joint tenancy and they go to Eve Spisato at her death. On the attorney's fees issue, the trial court awarded attorney's fees against my client under the Heller case. Heller and the cases after Heller, which have awarded attorney's fees and made an exception to the American rule, have all involved situations where somebody was acting under a formal fiduciary relationship. Heller was a trustee, there was a personal representative in one case, and there was a custodian, a statutory custodian. The trial court's ruling would extend Heller to all those cases where a fiduciary relationship is found to exist. It would extend it to partnerships, corporations, spiritual advisors, brokers. If the court's reasoning in extending Heller, and this is a significant extension of Heller, in basing Heller, the application on Heller, strictly on the finding that there may have been a fiduciary relationship, already in two decisions cited in our brief, I believe it was Bernard and Moore, or Stevens, this court has said that the mere existence of a fiduciary relationship is not enough. They've recognized that Heller was intended to apply to those cases where there was a formal fiduciary relationship. I would ask this court to see the danger in extending Heller to this incredibly broad class of litigants so that who would be willing to step in for a disabled or elderly friend or family member and try to help them when they were asked, if they thought in doing so, they would later have a judgment entered against them, and not only that, but they would have to pay interest on that judgment for 9 years, as Mr. Hess requires, and that they'd have to pay attorney's fees. That extension of Heller would wreak havoc with situations where volunteers step forward under these circumstances. Finally, I'd like to address the frivolous, the award of attorney's fees under the frivolous Claim Statute 1317.102 and Rule 11. The question is, what duty of investigation does a party have before instituting a lawsuit? In this case, the claims asserted against my client with interest would have totaled over $700,000. Yet Mr. Hess and his attorneys admit to only one limited telephone conversation with any of the numerous key witnesses that they could have talked to in order to determine what was really going on here with Bonnie Ritchie and Eve Spisato.
Counsel, do you have any citations as to the extent of a an investigation prior to filing a complaint that would help substantiate your claim?
We cite both Bielowski and Wold in our brief, Your Honor, and in both of those cases, the court was looking at a failure to investigate. The court looks at the reasoning of the trial court. The trial court's reasoning for not awarding fees was Yves Bisotto's failure to have agreed to dismiss claims against her as personal representative. Now, I would first of all set forward that there's many arguments in Mr. Hess's briefs relating to settlement negotiations. Not only are they improper, but they're misleading. But in any event, the court was basing its decision on an irrelevant ground. Yves Bisotto was represented separately by counsel in connection with her actions as personal representative. How could that have anything to do with whether or not Mr. Hess and his attorneys failed to reasonably investigate these claims before they proceeded? Who on this panel would not have bothered to call Bonnie Ritchie's longtime physician, Dr. Guymon, and ask him about capacity? Dr. Guymon would have told him up until 2000, he had no doubt that Bonnie Ritchie had capacity. Who on the panel would not have bothered to talk to the caregiver, Gene Sloan, from 1997 till 2000, in order to find out what was Bonnie Ritchie's capacity, who had hired her, who was paying her, who wouldn't have bothered?
How would they have gotten past the doctor-patient privilege?
They had a medical release.
They had a medical release.
That's right. They had a medical release, and they got all these other records. Why not talk to her physician?
Mr. Hess was holding a medical release that entitled the doctors to talk with him.
And I had no trouble talking to the doctor, but in fact there was a medical release, and numerous.
Excuse me, ma'am. This medical release existed before the lawsuit was filed.
Yes, Your Honor. And they had Dr. Guymon's name through discovery in the prior proceeding.
And the medical release told the doctor he could talk to anyone who came to him to ask him questions? Well,
it was sufficient to release all our other medical records and information. I don't think there was any limitation in it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
Counsel, you have 8 minutes and 36 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Before you get started and go ahead and run the clock, I have a question here right off the bat. What about this medical release? I don't remember it being referenced anywhere in either party's briefs before us. Did a medical release?
We had an authorization to get medical records, which we obtained. And the authorization was granted by the estate. And as far as I know, I haven't read it in more than 2 years, but I don't recall that it authorized us to talk to personal physicians. We used it to get records. We had the same authorization to get financial records.
And that was granted before you filed suit?
Yes.
Okay.
We had the medical records and the financial records before we filed suit. Mr. Hess painstakingly went through and correlated the dates of transfers with the dates of findings in the medical records as to the competency of Mrs. Ritchie. And then we took her deposition as part of the petition to remove her as PR. And there were significant admissions in the deposition. So we felt we had a basis to file a petition. We didn't feel it was brought in bad faith. Once we got the motion for summary judgment, we tried to narrow our case down to what we felt we had a chance, good chance, logical good chance to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, and skip claims that we felt would be a distraction to Judge Munsinger. And that's what we did. So there's a you know, if you dismiss prior to trial when confronted with evidence that opposes your petition, you're not subject to the attorney fee statute. Judge Munsinger didn't even make his finding on that statute. He denied the motion for attorney fees. So.
What's our standard of review with regard to that ruling?
Discretion.
Is it abuse of discretion standard?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
Was the deposition you took of Ms. Posado in the action to remove her as PR proceedings part of this record before?
Yes.
Before Judge Munsinger?
Yes. So the relief that we are asking for here is, first of all, that the court affirm the trial court's award of $44,264.75 to the estate and affirm the award of attorney's fees and costs, and that the case be remanded for a new trial on undue influence with instructions to order the $101,000 from Wells Fargo, from the Wells Fargo account restored to the estate, that interest be calculated from the date of breach of fiduciary duty instead of from the date of death, and reverse the finding that the M&G royalties were an inter vivos gift because there was no delivery of the gift. The necessary transfer forms at BLM were never completed.
And that's which one? Which one was the inter vivos gift?
The M&G royalties.
Okay, thank you.
And alternatively, that the gift was of a life estate only. Judge Munsinger found in the summary judgment order that it was a life estate. Ms. Posado testified it was a life estate, but the judge, he did a post-trial, post-order ruling, an amendment to his order in which he said it was a fee simple interest. And then also reversed the finding that the codicils should be admitted to probate. If they're an inter vivos gift, they can't be a testamentary gift. And by their terms, they purport to be an inter vivos gift, but the gift, the race of the gift, that is the assignment of the royalties, was never delivered.
Is there any possibility that the admission of those codicils to probate was harmless error? Is it necessarily harmful to you?
No, because it just gives an alternative basis for awarding Mrs. Sposato the M&G royalty. So in that sense, it is harmful. The court's final order was the court's summary judgment order was it's a life estate, but we don't know if it was an inter vivos gift or if it was a testamentary gift. In the order that he entered amending his findings, he found that it was a fee estate and that it was an inter vivos gift and that it took effect on the date of the gift and that she was entitled to all royalties from that point forward instead of a testamentary gift, which would take effect at death. So, if there are no other questions, that concludes my argument. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. And
can I add one?
Yes, you had a couple of minutes left.
Okay, the court ordered Mr. Kirch to file a supplemental pleading in which he was to set forth this is in the attorney fees case number 1139, mm-hmm. to cite where the issues were preserved for appeal in the record. And that was not done. So we think that the attorney's fees appeal should just be dismissed. There was a supplemental pleading filed, but it was for the findings what I'll call the underlying case, the principal case, case number 417.
I think we got one in both cases.
Oh, I'm sorry, I only received one. I apologize. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The matter will stand submitted. And an opinion will issue in due course. The court will now be in recess, and the bailiff.